he's standing up for your rights and taking no prisoners in the fight for truth. The Glenn Beagle Show starts right now on AM 700 KBYR.
Good afternoon, folks. It's 4.05 p.m. This is the Glenn Beagle Show, and it's my pleasure to be with you. I'll tell you what, this election looks like it's going to be a lot closer than it otherwise should be, but it does look very positive. I want to report to you right now, the exit polls look like it's going to be about a five-point margin in Wisconsin, and that is a margin that is probably about one-third of what it would normally be without fraud, cheating, and abuse. There was a judge a while ago in Wisconsin who actually went to the extent to say you can't ask for voter for ID when someone goes to the polls. Fraud, abuse. That you only have to be in Wisconsin 28 days, and this was longer than 28 days before the election. I wonder how it is that Madison, where there is a there's a college, I wonder how it is that they might come up with 119% of the people who live there voting. You can register to vote at the polls. No, it's got to be really simple. We went through this process where we had the presidential preference poll here in the state of Alaska. And I think there were about 20 of us. There were about three or four, maybe even five people per precinct, trying to figure out whether or not somebody was registered as a Republican. If they weren't, get them registered as a Republican, make sure that they qualified to vote in the state of Alaska. I mean, we went through an enormous amount of checking and testing where there were photo IDs. There was, oh, the process was amazing. The ability to register at the polling place and establish that you have been there for 28 days. How exactly are you going to do that? How is it possible? Today we will be covering the issues in Wisconsin, and it is glorious. It's very exciting. I'm also going to have somebody call up from the Anchorage Tea Party. They're going to give us a review of how do people cheat in elections. And specifically, how are they cheating right now, today? It's going on. We know about it. We know that they're cheating. We know they're in the midst of it. We probably will know at the end of it exactly how many people cheated. We will know what the results of this election would have been without them cheating, even though they're still going to lose. Isn't it great when people cheat and they still lose? I love that. I like it when people cheat and they still lose. That feels good to me. Now, I want our side to know that we have a lot of work to do before we can have elections that we can be proud of. And we are going to need to fight this one. And I think that this election, it's actually taking on more of an importance. The election in Wisconsin is more important than I originally thought it would be because we are going to be able to detail exactly how the Democrats will cheat if they're given the chance and exactly what we have to do in order to prevent them. In fact, it's risen so high of a priority in my mind that we may actually need to pass a constitutional amendment to defend our voting. We may not be able to let California decide that they can have 10 million or whatever it would be, 500,000 or a million people illegally vote. We may not be able to allow California to do that. We may need to override the irresponsibility of California and New York. And as 38 states override the will of the states that say, you know what, cheating is fine in our state. We want you to cheat. We want you to come here. If you know of dead people who haven't voted, we want you to vote for them. And we may have to override. That's how high the priority for me is. Looking at the cheating that's going on. So I'm actually looking forward. I know that they're going to lose. I'm glad they're going to lose. And I'm looking forward to detailing to you. And it's important that we remember exactly how they're cheating, how much cheating went on, how they did it, whether or not we can stop it, how we can stop it in the least intrusive way and make sure that everybody's right to vote, who's legally entitled to vote, is protected. We have to walk through these things. We have to learn from this. Every time the left is forced to act, just like when you force people to vote on an issue in the legislature, people vote for it, people vote against it. You learn about people who vote both ways. You learn whether or not they're strong, they voted for it. You learn whether or not they're weak, they voted against it. So that is but one of the issues that we're going to touch on today. In addition to that, at the bottom of the hour, I'll have Brad Keithley on. He's an expert in economics, particularly in the economics of the state of Alaska. And in the next hour, I will have attorney Stephen Merrill on, and he will be covering an unbelievable development in the militia trial. You would not believe who took the stand. People tell you don't take the stand, that you're not your best witness. The last thing you want to do, if you're trying to defend yourself, is to take the stand in your own defense. Well, that is not the way that Schaefer Cox has approached his trial. In a pink tie, no less. In a trial all about him. Boy, wouldn't you hate to be somebody charged at the same time he was. That will come up. In the next hour, attorney Stephen Merrill will be with me at 5:15. And I've got other updates coming during the program. Let me go to one of them. Randy Reedrick, chairman of the Republican Party. Randy, how are you doing?
I am pleased to be able to join you today and talk about the fact that I think we're doing a pretty good job from reports I've seen of getting our people to the polls in Wisconsin.
Now, Randy, the other side wanted a big turnout. I don't believe that for one second, they only want one big turnout, and that's the turnout of their voters. If regular voters turn out in mass, what you get is what we got, and that is they lose.
As long as we do a good job of turning out our voters in a place where we have enough people, we can win. We should never let them try to outflank us.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that little election in the Matsu Valley that got Larry DeVilbiss elected.
Oh, yeah.
That was an 11% turnout in January. We managed to get enough people to the polls. People said low turnouts are dangerous.
That's right.
Now, any turnout where you don't mobilize enough of your folks is dangerous.
Well, look, I think a lot of people in the middle were mobilized, and they're going to suffer what looks to be a 5-point loss. I was hoping for a 10-point loss. But frankly, this is a pretty big deal. The Democrats had every opportunity to make their case. They had plenty of money. They had plenty of energy. They had every union person. They had people cheating. And
they
I'm going to have an update on that.
And he didn't want to go take credit for the loss.
Who did? Oh, Obama. That's right. That's right.
They decided they couldn't get there. And, of course, today the Democrat, or the last 2 days, the Democrat spin machine was backed off saying, well, this is just about not removing somebody from office who hasn't done anything criminally wrong as a way to soft sell the thing. I was extremely surprised that once it became hopeless, they decided that the field had gotten to be only 70 yards long and this was an easy touchdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, forgetting that they had to go the last 30 yards. The Tea Party make a difference here?
I think any group of folks that will help us turn out, that gives us a secondary motivation, or tertiary motivation, whether it's the Tea Party, which has been very, very influential in Wisconsin. Ron Johnson came into the process by going to Tea Party rallies. Where is he today? He is a United States senator. Don't know that we need to say more about the relevance of the Tea Party there. Mm-hmm. You have Tea Party folks, NRA groups, Right to Life, other fiscal and social conservative groups. They're all additive because it's all about making sure that our folks go vote.
Well, I think when the facts were laid before Wisconsin voters that most people who were not union members, most people who wanted a right-to-work state, who wanted a fair level playing field between private sector workers and public sector workers, and who were desperately worried about an $8.2 billion shortfall and tens of billions of dollars in potential shortfall for future pension benefits, I think they became our voters.
Well, I think, you know, did you see the article in the Wall Street Journal today about the changing attitude towards unions, especially the education unions?
No, I have not.
You need to go find that article and take a look at it. It basically suggests that something like 20% of the electorate has changed their attitude in a fairly short period of time, and the national education unions are losing thousands and thousands of members. They have done it. They expect more, and that reduces the force dues that they can collect and use, which reduces their power further. So maybe we can get education back to being something about educating our young people rather than entitlements.
Well, and indoctrination, too. It's so terrible. Right, right.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the most offensive part of it, is that a bunch of leftists, I know there are a lot of teachers out there who aren't dramatically on the left. They're just a member of a union who happens to be. But they have no power to stop the unions from propagating massive leftist beliefs.
Well, actually, we have an awful lot of what I would call conservative teachers who really get the
Absolutely.
Job done correctly.
Yes, yes, we do.
And to have less union power over them will make them more capable of doing the job they want to do in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I'm looking forward to a good result in Wisconsin. I know with certain precincts, leftist precincts, voting at 119%, they expect. I imagine, we know that they're actually going to fight the vote, too. They're going to do a recount. They're going to go through the whole process. They got hundreds of lawyers. This is the future of the United States of America. If people who are claim to be independents do not back away from the danger of the left party.
Well, indecision or lack of focus doesn't help us. We need engaged citizens.
Well, I think they've just been convinced by the media that Republicans are just bad people. They want people to starve. They don't like poor people. They don't like black people, none of which could be further from the truth. But they're really having to think, wait a minute, we don't have an economy that we can actually get a job in here. Let's take another look at Republicans. Maybe they have something they can offer me more than the Democrats.
I think that's well said. Enjoy your show. We'll talk to you later.
All right. I appreciate it. Randy Riedrich, chairman of the Republican Party. And we've gone a little bit long in this segment. I'll be back in just a little bit. This is the Glenn Beagle Show. I wanted to tell you about sponsor for this hour of the program, Matt Valley Meats, my good friends of mine out 4 miles from Osceola on the PWH. They just have freezer fillers. You can get your moose processed there, your fish processed there, and nothing. There's no better thing I can do for your family. Your family is begging you. Do not feed us more moose steak or bear steak. Please get it processed. Make it into Italian sausage. Make it into some chorizo sausage. Make it something special that we can look forward to every night. Make the family dinner something special, something great. Matt Valley Meats, 357-9215, the hour sponsor of this hour of the program. I will be right back. Stay tuned. The biggest political story of the year and a harbinger for the future of the country and the future of political debate. Many, many things we will learn from this. Let me go to the phones here. Talk to David. David, welcome to KBYR.
This is pretty awesome what seems to be taking place in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm really sort of heartened to hear that Randy Riedrich is softening a little bit on the Tea Party, too, that he's actually coming around a little bit away from his stance of government corporate cooperation, Lisa Murkowski kind of government.
Yeah, and, you know, I like it when he can give us a leg up. I like it when he can talk positively about us. And the Tea Party was huge in Wisconsin, and
yeah.
I have more to say about it. But I appreciate the comment from you.
You know, it was you only had to pull about two teeth for him to acknowledge that the Tea Party had a little bit to do with it. And, you know, I just wish that he would soften some of the vitriol and lies, outright lies that he's telling people about the Ron Paul people now.
Now, tell me about what's going on.
The Ron Paul people.
Tell me about what's going on this Saturday.
Okay, the Ron Paul people, let me first clarify that. That's just kind of code for people that are for limited government and constitutional government.
I don't take it as a slight at all. If you say you're a Ron Paul person, I don't take it as a slight, and I hope other people don't hear it that way. You're not fringe. You're not weird. You just want people to mean what they say. That's what 99% of the Ron Paul people want. Now, there is a small fringe element of people who think the world can be perfected if Alaska just pulls up all of its troops and the rest of the world will be fine. But I don't think that's not the majority of people in the Ron Paul. They just want limited government.
I don't know anybody in the Ron Paul movement of the hundreds of people that I know in the Ron Paul movement that think the world is going to be greatly improved by the United States troops leaving. I just don't think we're going to be harmed as much as the world is going to be helped by us continuing.
And that might be. We have to be strong for sure. If we're going to project force, we have to be strong here locally. But tell me a little bit about what's going on Saturday. I'm very reticent to turn the party over to Russ, who I consider a friend. And so I'm reticent to go. So convince me.
Well, here's the deal. I think that at this point in time, we're moving into one of the most important elections Alaska's had for the conservative movement in a long time. You know, we've had this redistricting. We have brand new people that are trying to take office in districts that really have never existed before in their form.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that we should, at this point in time, filter out whether or not you're a corporate government cooperative Republican and only back those candidates and not back the candidates that are for limited government.
So you think at this point that if the Republican Party stays the way that it is, because the candidates are already set, we can't have any new candidates. If nobody's running against Gary Stevens and Bert Stedman, nobody's going to run against them. I mean, we didn't find a candidate to run, or, you know, I don't know if we did or not, but I'm just saying the candidates are all set for the primary, but the Republican Party doesn't take a position in the primary for any Republican Party races.
Well, I just know that there are people that Randy is well aware of have leanings towards constitutionalist government that he is actively not helping.
Right. Well, look, it's too late, and I have heard stories of that. So you think that if we got Russ in there, that you know, things would be better. We'd be able to help candidates we're supposed to.
I think that we need to help all of the candidates that are running under the Republican ticket.
No, we don't have enough money for that.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
But we can at least help them with advice.
Yes.
I mean, to just tell them you're on your own.
But do you need Randy out of his office to help candidates with advice?
Yes.
I mean, because that's.
Oh yes.
You can't do it yourselves.
Okay. Let me put it this way.
All right.
I went in for a candidate yesterday into the Fairbanks Street. What's that called? Division of Elections, I think it's called.
Okay.
And found a voter list of the Republicans in our district for them.
Uh-huh.
And they had just approached Randy within a few days before that and asked him for the same list. And Randy wanted $500 for a list I could get there for $20.
Yeah, well, he can't give you the list. It's not legal.
I don't know. You know, all I know is that he offered some list for $500.
Well, here's
and it was the same words.
You just have to take my. I appreciate it. Hey, David, the Republican Party can't give out its information. It has a value. The Republican Party has invested money in it. It can't just give it away. And it's not because it's looking for money. It's just not legal for them to do so. They have to charge people fair market value, and then it goes in as a contribution and so on and so forth. In primaries, the Republican Party is not allowed or doesn't, by its own rules, it's not allowed to contribute to people's campaigns. So anyway, so that's basically the way that it goes. There's a legal value to it, and the Republican Party doesn't have the right to give it out, is my understanding. Okay, let me go to the phones and continue on with your comments here. I'll go to Eric. Eric, welcome to KBYR. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I was calling about, I have a concern about the radical transformation of this nation. It's going from civil service to banking and lending and the loan officer being President Obama. I mean, you know, since we abandoned the budgetary concerns of the nation and started investing in corporations or companies, when did civil service get thrown out the window?
Civil service, as in what? Are we talking about Wisconsin here, or just in general?
In general.
I see. So do you think that, because we used to call them civil servants, do you think they're not civil servants anymore, or what?
They're loan officers.
Like loaning the next generation's wealth to this generation?
Lending industry based on foreign funds.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Well, that's what happens when you're a creditor nation. You don't or a debtor nation. You have to use other people's money. Oh, you're going to help get rid of the current crew out of the White House, help try to get a balanced budget amendment in, or what?
Basically, I believe it's unconstitutional so far.
Well, actually, I don't know that it's unconstitutional, but I know that I believe it was Benjamin Franklin said the greatest threat to our democracy is intergenerational debt, because that's something that one person takes from another that the other person doesn't have the right to say no. They don't have the ability to say no to. So when you use the government to steal from another generation, that's the greatest threat, because it's so immoral, and that's what I think he was worried about.
Okay.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you, Eric. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Coming up on the other side of the break, I have Brad Keithley, who is an expert in the economics here of Alaska. And Alaska, if you didn't know, I mean, here's a surprising, shocking piece of information. We just traversed into deficit spending territory in the state of Alaska. We've been getting billions and billions of dollars and putting it into bank accounts. So I guess it's time to start spending that. And the real problem is oil production again down over 7%. It's rising in virtually all of our competitor states. It's rising in North Dakota. It's rising in Wyoming. It's rising in Pennsylvania. It's rising in Texas. It's rising in Alberta. And it's going down dramatically here. What are we doing wrong? Do we have time to fix it? Are we strong enough to be able to say, you know what, we are going to have to do with less government, but we'll have more employment to show for it? Is that a good trade, and are Alaskans willing to make that trade? I sure hope so. I mean, what a great positive relationship that you have with your employer, and it's not so positive when you have one with your welfare officer. It's a change in thinking. It's a change in the questions that we ask, but Brad Keithley is going to walk us through where is the state of Alaska, where are we heading, how much time do we have to turn this around. And then I'll ask the harder questions. Do you think Alaska is strong enough to take smaller government? Are we ready to have a larger industry? And for that, will we take smaller government? I'll be back. This is the Glenn Beagle Show. It's my pleasure to be with you. It is Tuesday, 4:29 p.m. This is KBYR, Alaska Talks here. Stay tuned. All right, folks, welcome back. Good afternoon, 4:34 p.m., AM 700 KBYR. I've got Brad Keithley here in studio with me, who is from Perkins Coie Law Firm, and I read a piece of his about the situation in the state of Alaska, and I want to welcome you to KBYR, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for having me on today.
We have a lot of decisions to make and probably a lot of changes to go through in the state of Alaska. People always think maybe that change is a bad thing, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I went from 18 to 19 living in a house to living on my own. There was a lot of changes there. Some of them were less pleasant than others, but frankly, it's what you do when you grow up. It's what you do. You can always change for the better. Your piece to me was about the need for Alaska to take a look around itself, assess, maybe reassess, and figure out which way are we going to go. Tell us about the piece that you wrote. Tell us about yourself first.
Sure. Well, I've been a practicing lawyer, oil and gas lawyer, for 30-some-odd years. I've focused on Alaska for nearly 20 years, and I've lived here permanently for the last 5 years. I was also lived here for a while in the mid-1990s. And I've come later in life to the state, but I've adopted the state. And really have started focusing on the issues that are confronting the state, first as an oil and gas lawyer, and then beyond that, because they're so intertwined, the fiscal policy issues that the state's facing.
Oil has declined since 1987 or 1988, somewhere in there, right. I don't know. Why can it go back up? Why now? What's different about now?
Well, I think we have a lot of opportunities on the oil side, and really where we need to focus from the standpoint of state government is on state lands, because that's where we get the benefit of oil royalty as well as production taxes. And we have a lot of opportunities inside existing fields to stabilize and increase production. When you look at Prudhoe Bay, for example, in the developed North Slope, the testimony before the legislature has been only about 50% of the resource that's available inside those existing units has been developed. Now, the additional resource that's there to be developed is in strata or in layers above where Prudhoe's historically been produced, and those are going to be more difficult to produce because it's viscous oil and heavy oil. We'll take some leaps in technology, and we'll take increased investment. But the resource is there, and the challenge is developing an economic environment that enables developing the technology to get at that resource.
So you brought up a couple of things, and I want to go over both of them, because the Democrats' view of the state of Alaska, to me, makes sense in if we were out of oil, if we didn't have more oil to get, if we were essentially managing our decline, managing the decline of Prudhoe Bay, and taking as much money as we could as the oil companies essentially left the state and went out the door. What you're telling me is that is not the case.
No. We have a huge resource potential still on state lands that, again, gives us the double benefit of royalty and production taxes, a huge opportunity. But it's going to take investment to get at it, and it's going to take technology to get at it. And the fiscal environment we've created in this state, both from the revenue side, the tax side, as well as from the spend side, is really working against us in developing that resource.
What do you hear when you hear people say it's our oil?
Well, I hear people, you know, claiming that we have an entitlement to any revenues really we want out of that oil, and I don't think that's fair.
In other words, it's our oil, it's not your profit. You produce, their only purpose in being in the state of Alaska is to provide me
yes.
with as much money from my oil as I can get.
Right.
And that's what you hear.
Yes, yes. And I think that's generally the case of the producer side when they hear that mantra, that's the reaction.
See, I worry that people who think that, who have that sense of entitlement, because I hear that same thing, that they're not capable of being a good partner.
It's a challenge. Alaska has to find a way to be a good partner with industry. There are different ways to do it, some of which have been discussed in the legislature, some of which I think are going to be discussed in future legislatures. But Alaska has to find a way to be a partner.
Is that a good word for it?
It is.
I mean, the way that it's our oil people hear that is we're to be their slave. I mean, I don't see. I never thought of 40% to 50%. Total tax take as being a slave to anyone. I hear that as, gosh, that's a really high tax rate. It sounds great for the state of Alaska. It's amazing how if it's 70% tax take, then, you know, that's fine. We're taking as much as we can from them. If it's 40 to 50%, which I think is what the governor is proposing, now we're their slave. Now they just have us over the barrel. And we're, you know, for some reason, we're not getting a fair share of the value of the oil. I guess I don't understand it, which puts me at a disadvantage to debating people.
Well, in all fairness, I think even the governor's proposal is not getting us where we ultimately need to be, not in terms of the economics, but in terms of your word, the word that you use, partnership. What we're doing is we're sort of defining a given quantity of revenues, of known revenues that we think we're going to get, and we're fighting about how to divide them up between the industry and the state, and that fight continues even under the governor's proposal, I think. What we need to do is we need to come to a different way of thinking about this. We need to come to a way about how we, the state, and the industry align to think about increasing the pie, going out after additional resources, after additional revenues. And we've just not created an environment in which that's occurring.
Is it possible that there's a lot of debate about whether or not all of the known oil reserves in the world have been found, and the Green River find down south is really throwing a monkey wrench into this? There's a lot of people in the state of Alaska who think, you know what? If we don't produce this for 10 years, if we don't produce it for 500 years, think of what it'll be worth then. they may be wrong. They may be wrong in that two things might occur. First of all, if there's not peak oil, if we haven't found all the oil, if the oil actually is being created by the earth, we don't know. Or we find so much more of it, or we move away from oil. We may not need Alaskan oil if we don't produce as much of the oil as we can right now, create as many jobs as we can right now. Those jobs, that value, that wealth, may not even exist 100 years from now.
I think that's fair. There's a great story about the United Kingdom who had a couple of great coal reserves in the middle of Great Britain and set those reserves aside for the day when coal was going to be an astronomical value and it was going to maintain the state of the economy in Great Britain. Well, what happened was the coal age passed, the oil age came about. Those reserves have nowhere near the value that they were.
And the United States bought the state of Alaska, which has enough coal to provide for the entire world's energy needs for 500 or 1,000 years. Is that right?
Yes, yes, yes.
So they thought what a lot of people, because I talked to a lot of people with a lot of different ideas about the way they want the world to be and the way that they conceive of this is how the economics of it. If we keep it, it just goes up in value. It just becomes more valuable. That may be wrong, and that is a very important thing for people to realize.
Well, I think that's part of it, Glenn. And part of it also is we need to, I mean, if you look at what's been going on the spend side from state government, we need to monetize the oil reserves fairly early on to continue to generate revenues not only to deal with the spend side that we've created, but also to create wealth, to create financial wealth for future generations of Alaskans when oil declines. And jobs, when oil inevitably declines out there.
Because if we create enough of an infrastructure, we may be able to do other things up here. We may have mining. I mean, Pebble could operate for 120 years. We may have shale oil. We may have gas hydrates, you know.
That's all the case. That's all possible. Of course, the state revenue that comes out of things like mining is not significant. If we try to tax that at the level we're taxing oil, we're not going to have a mining industry.
No.
What our real opportunity is to take the financial resources that are being developed from the oil, turn that into financial investments and a financial pot, and be able to sustain a level of living going forward in the state.
We're getting back to your article here called Alaska Fiscal Policy, Where We Have Gone Wrong, and I'm talking with Brad Keithley, and you can go to bgkeithley.com in order to read the article. It's kind of a siren song for state of Alaska. You have a limited number of options here. We've chosen one path and chosen that very strongly. And there are people, it's hard to change direction once you're going in a certain direction, because the ability to change it requires oftentimes supermajorities of the legislature, all three houses to be aligned, the people to understand where we're going, a vision from the governor. A lot of things have to happen in order for us to change course, and that's sort of what we're fighting about right now. We've taken a strong stance about how high our oil taxes should be. When we come back, again, I'm talking with Brad Keithley, and if you have questions, please call 274-5297, 274-KBYR, toll-free is 1-866-610-KBYR. You can email me as well, Glenn with one N at KBYR.com. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about this ICER study and the decision that we have made, the decision to be uncompetitive in a world essentially awash in oil with lots and lots of places where people can go find it. What is it going to take for Alaska to be competitive? Do we in our hearts want to be competitive? Is this, it's my oil, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to? Is that so strong now that we can't break out of it? I hope that's not the case. But lots left to talk about. Your phone calls as well, 274-5297. Brad Keithley from Perkins Coie is in studio with me. We'll be right back. After all I knew, it had to be something. All right. Welcome back to the program. 4:47 p.m., and it is Tuesday. Brad Keithley from Perkins Coie is in studio with me, and we're talking about the way people, everyday average people. It's funny, in a republic, everyday average people, we're the ones who go to the polls where the thank you, Mr. Producer. Somebody has fooled around with his sound files, I take it. But average people have to understand a lot about economics, a lot about history, a lot about competitiveness in order for us to tell our legislators, here's what we want. So that's why we keep having these conversations over and over again. Can I take a couple calls for you, Brad?
Absolutely.
All right, let me go to the phones here, 274-5297 to John. John, welcome to KBYR. You're on with Brad Keithley.
Yeah, hi there. I've been listening to your program and been retired from the oil company for a number of years. And what the public doesn't think about is when you're dealing with an international oil consortium, there's a thing called return on investment that they're very interested in. And at the meeting, they'll get together and they'll say, well, Mr. Jones, you're the head of this company down here, let's say in South America or wherever, and says, what's your return on investment? And when he says, well, we're doing about 28% now. Oh, well, okay. How about Mr. Smith up there in Alaska? How are you doing? Well, our return on investment is 8%. Oh, well, guess where that company's going to spend their money?
Yeah, and that's certainly true. That there's a lot of factors that go into the investment decisions, but that's certainly a major one. And when you have tax rates that are at the level that we have taken the tax rates to, you don't measure up very well compared with other investment opportunities.
Let me go to Paul. Paul, welcome to KBYR. You're on with Brad Keithley.
Hi, Brad. Hi, Glenn. How y'all doing?
Good.
Yeah. Look, I never worked in the oil patch. You know, I'm just a dumb old redneck cowboy. But I have enough sense to know. I've been around this place long enough, about 35 years, to realize that first of all, these folks use the excuse that, well, see, the production's up. See, they're exploring more. See, we're going to get more oil, and so we don't really have to do anything else. They're lying. They don't realize. People like French don't realize that the folks in the oil industry look years ahead. When you hear Shell saying, well, we're going to go and pull the oil out of here or export something, it's not something they thought of last week. It's something that they've thought of years ago, and it's something that they've been working towards, and it's something they're going to do. I'm looking at future investment and filling that pipeline for this state, or everyone's going to leave. And it's one thing that I would say that may help a whole lot, because we have what I consider an entire Senate and House full of Democrats, except for three or four of them, and they can call themselves Republicans all they want. Is that most of these guys, most of these folks, are up for election. Coming up in November, and that we have the power right now to change out the legislature, and if we do that with the right folks, we'll get a decent return on what is our resource. It does belong to us. Mm-hmm. What is our resource? And the oil companies will get what they need, which is they need to justify what they do to their shareholders.
Yeah, and you made an excellent point early on that. That there's a lot of people point to, like Senator French and Senator Wilkowski point to, the level of exploration that's going on. Well, if you look at the actual volumes that's coming out of those exploration efforts, they're very small. They're not insignificant. They're not just a few barrels, but they're very small compared to the volumes that we're losing every year in production decline. We're not even coming close to offsetting the production decline with those exploration efforts. So it's going to take more than simply those sorts of things to levelize and to increase production going forward. And frankly, Senator French and Senator Wilkowski and others just aren't paying attention to those additional things.
Let me go back. 274-5297, 274-KBYR. I'm here with Brad Keithley from Perkins Coie. You can go to bgkeithley.com, K-E-I-T-H-L-E-Y, and see the article which caught my eye, Alaska Fiscal Policy, Where We Have Gone Wrong. 274-5297 again. Jeff, welcome to the program. You're on with Brad.
Hey, Glenn, Brad. I just had one comment and one question. The comment is, I've talked to a lot of people who work on the slope, and, you know, guys like Les Guerra and, you know, Wilkowski cite the employment's up and there's all these maintenance jobs. But a lot of people I've talked to have said they're more like compliance jobs, you know, to comply with regulations and things the state has done. But my question is, Brad, and I just tuned in, but have you talked about the fact that new budget, I read, balances around $100 a barrel, which starts July 1st, and, you know, just the growth of the spending since, you know, the revenues have increased when the price of oil has been, you know, over $100 a barrel? And that's my question.
Excellent point, and it's the point that I try to make in the article. The break-even price in the new budget actually is $108 a barrel.
Oh, my gosh.
The price...
That is recessionary. I don't know if people realize this. If the United States has to pay $108 a barrel, our country will automatically be in recession if we don't spend trillions of dollars we don't have.
Yeah, and the projections, future projections of price go up from there to justify future budgets. We've really gone beyond the point of injuring ourselves in our spending. I have a couple of figures in the article that talk about spending levels. In fiscal year 2004 and 2006, for example, we spent at a rate of $2.3 billion in 2004, $2.3 billion in 2005, and $3 billion in 2006. Now that's spending from the general fund, and that was well within our means in those years. That was well within a level that people refer to as the sustainable level of spending. Since 2008, which was the first budget of the Palin administration, here's the numbers. And keep in mind, the highest number prior to this was $3 billion. Since the beginning of the Palin administration, it was $4.25 billion in the first year, $5 billion in the second year, $4.23 billion in the third year, $5.1 billion in the fourth year. Now listen to these last 2 years. $6.72 billion last year, the current year we're in, and next year's budget is $7.6 billion from the general fund. The level that ICER has calculated, Glenn referred to the ICER study, the level that ICER has calculated as being the sustainable level, that is the level at which we can spend and have revenues to sustain that level on into the future, even as oil inevitably declines, the level that ICER has calculated is roughly $5.35 billion. That's the level that we ought to be spending at, taking the rest of it, putting it in the bank, like you and I prepare for our retirement, preparing for the day when oil continues to decline and generating revenues out there in the future. But right now, against that 5.35 level, last year we spent $6.72 billion, and this year the legislature's approved $7.6
billion. I think one of the things that's left out, too, from what you just said, is the $5.3 billion still requires billions of dollars of investment every year.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we can't leave that out because right now we're not getting the investment
Absolutely. That
we need. We're
Absolutely.
Getting about $1 billion, I think, of investment, but we need $2, $3, $4, $5 billion a year in order to stop the decline that's going on in the oil pipeline, pump more oil out of the more viscous sources.
Excellent point. Commissioner Sullivan last fall estimated that we needed $4 to $5 billion a year in order to sort of sustain the level that we were at now. And not even start increasing back up to the $5 billion level. That's the level, the $4 to $5 billion is the
level of investment.
Of investment.
From
right.
private sector sources.
Yeah, from some source.
Because
yes.
they call, I don't know if you know this, but they call taxes investments now. So it could get a little confusing for people.
Well, taxes aren't investments.
No,
taxes
not.
Are de-investing. but $4 to $5 billion is what we need to go after the additional resources that we know are on state lands. And you're right, Glenn. We're at roughly $1 billion. In terms of apples to apples, we're at roughly $1 billion to $1.5 billion at that level now.
I know we're paying off some of our future debts to our public employees and teachers retired. I know that is what at least some of this unbelievable. I mean, this is, what is it? That's over 200% growth. It's like if I made $100,000 this year, 6 years from now, I'd be spending $300,000, $320,000. It's unbelievable to even conceive of these numbers. Will the state of Alaska, I mean, it's grown so fast, will the state of Alaska even realize if we sort of drop back down to what we were at 2009?
Well, a large part of the growth has been in the capital budget, and the capital budget is something that you can control fairly simply from year to year, although, you know, that's something that drives construction jobs. Quite a bit, and dropping back on the capital budget will have some impact there. So we'll see some impact in that.
So we
sector.
Would need some offset from state spending in the private sector, like Pebble, like new roads out to resources, something along those lines.
Yeah, to maintain the same level of spending overall in the state, we would need the private sector to increase its investment in the state. What we're really doing is we're sort of sucking money out of the private sector and trying to give it back. I mean, Senator Stedman talks about we need to make these investments in order to stimulate the economy. We're trying to suck the money out of the private sector and re-stimulate the economy in the government sector. That sounds strangely like what Congress has been doing.
hasn't worked so well for them, for sure. Has anybody done a full review of if we want to maintain, you know, our current high level of unemployment or maybe see it drop, which is what I'd like to see, if we would like to keep our state, you know, in approximately maybe even the $5.3 billion, it's going to require this many projects a year, this much new investment. You talked about new investment, $4 to $5 billion. We're not getting a quarter of that. People didn't know that, so at least they know that part of it. Do we need projects like Pebble? You know, are there other projects that the state of Alaska should be looking at? Is oil enough? Do we need something else?
Well, I've looked mostly at the oil industry. Certainly, mining projects are good for the state in terms of employment. But if we're looking at state revenues, what makes the state government run? It's really oil. I mean, that's really where the
focus
is. Is
that all people ever ask about anymore? Because that's not what I ask. I have 8 kids, if you didn't know.
Wow.
And I need them to have jobs. You know, I mean, there's massive unemployment amongst young people. They're not getting that first job because people who are 40 years old are taking the jobs that people who are 30 years old were taking. People of 30 years old are taking jobs at McDonald's, and they're making it hard for my kids.
Yeah, well, to sustain employment, we're going to need mining projects and other projects as well.
Brad Keithley from Perkins Coie, I really appreciate you coming in here. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. And I hope people go out to his website, bgkeithley.com, bgkeithley.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Glenn.
I appreciate it. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Stay tuned.